Picture a Tuesday afternoon in Chillicothe, Ohio, 1924. The courthouse clock just struck two, and the men of that town are exactly where you would expect them to be on a weekday. Then somebody looks up. Three airplanes, two Curtiss Jennies and a standard J-1, come roaring in low over the grain elevator, trailing white smoke, their Ox-5 engines hammering at full throttle. By the time they bank over the post office, half the town is out in the street. By the time the lead plane rolls to a stop in somebody's pasture out on Route 40. There are 200 people already walking that direction. Children are running. Farmers are driving their Fords right across the field. The banker has left his desk. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. And today we're talking about the barnstorming era at the height of its power. Not the lone wolf in a Jenny selling hop rides for $2 and sleeping under the wing, though we've covered that story. Today we're talking about the man who took barnstorming and turned it into a machine, a traveling spectacle that hit more than 500 towns a season, that put more Americans in airplanes than any government program ever had, and that operated with a precision that the solo barnstormer scratching out a living in Missouri would have found almost unrecognizable. His name was Ivan Gates. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Ivan Gates was not a pilot. That is the first thing to understand about him, and it is the key to understanding why he succeeded where so many others in the barnstorming world were just getting by. He was a promoter, a showman. He had spent years before the First World War selling circus acts and boxing matches and county fair spectacles, and he had developed an unusually precise understanding of what American crowds would pay to see and how much they would pay to see it. When the war ended and suddenly there were thousands of surplus Curtiss Jenny biplanes on the market at $200 apiece, and thousands of young men who had learned to fly but had no commercial aviation industry to fly for, Gates saw something that most of the pilots themselves missed. He saw a business, not a summer hustle, not an adventure. A repeatable, scalable, manageable business with routes and schedules and overhead you could actually control. He founded the Gates Flying Circus in 1922, and within a few seasons it was the largest barnstorming operation in the United States. Pull up a chair. Because this is one of those stories that tells you as much about American character in the 1920s as any history book you will find. Here's how it worked. Gates employed advance men, which was the carnival term for scouts who went into a town 2 to 3 weeks before the main troop arrived. The advance man went to the local newspaper first. He offered an exclusive on the story, which meant the paper got a reporter on the field and a front page headline, and in exchange the paper ran the promotional notices for free or close to it. Then he went to the mayor's office, to the Rotary Club, to the hardware stores and feed cooperatives and barbershops. He found a suitable field, usually a farmer's pasture with enough cleared ground for the Jennies to operate, and he cut a deal. Flat fee for the farmer, sometimes a small percentage of the gate. By the time the flying circus arrived, the town already knew they were coming. The crowds were primed at its peak. The Gates Flying Circus was running 25 to 30 pilots, a dozen wing walkers and parachutists, 40-odd mechanics and ground crew, plus the advance men, the ticket sellers, and the gatekeepers. They moved through the Midwest and the South and the Mid-Atlantic states like a well-organized army, hitting a different field almost every day through the flying season. The show itself was built in layers, and Gates understood that each layer served a different purpose. The first layer was spectacle. The pilots flew low formation passes, traded altitudes, looped and spun, and did chandelles that made the crowd gasp and grab the person next to them. The smoke generators trailing white against the blue sky, the sound of those Ox-5 engines, that distinctive clatter and roar washing over the fields. At 100 feet, it rattled your teeth. People who had never been within 50 yards of an airplane suddenly understood, in their chests and their stomachs, what powered flight actually felt like. The wing walkers came next, men and women who climbed out onto the struts and leading edges while the plane was in flight, standing in 100-mile-per-hour wind, with nothing between them and the ground but faith and upper body strength. They changed planes in midair, stepping from one aircraft to another while the crowd below stopped breathing. They hung from bars mounted under the fuselage. They stood on the upper wing and waved to the people below. The parachutists went up to altitude, usually around 3,000 feet, and stepped off into the air. They delayed their pulls, the crowd below would watch a figure falling free for what felt like an impossibly long time, and at the moment when you were absolutely certain you were witnessing a tragedy, the canopy opened and the crowd exhaled as one. That is theater. Gates understood theater. But the third layer was where the money was. The ride's $5, $5 for a ride in a two-seat Jenny, passenger up front, Gates pilot in the back, 10 minutes around the field and back. $5 was real money in 1924, call it close to $100 in today's terms. But the line for rides started before the show started, and it did not end until the sun was too low to fly. Gates' pitchmen worked the crowd with the efficiency of carnival barkers who had moved up in the world. $5 a minute in the sky, the view you will remember for the rest of your life. Your grandchildren will ask you about this day, and the line shuffled forward. Farmers who had never spent $5 on anything that was not a tool or a seed, school teachers, bank clerks, wives whose husbands thought they were being reckless and who went anyway. Think about what that 10-minute ride actually meant to most of the people who took it. For the majority of those passengers, this was the first and very possibly the only time in their lives they would leave the ground in a machine. They climbed into the front cockpit of the Jenny, which smelled of castor oil and doped fabric and hot metal, and they pulled the leather helmet on and the goggles, and then the engine came up to power behind them and the field started moving under the wheels. There was a moment, somewhere around 40 miles per hour, where the ride changed. The bumping and shaking of the ground run stopped, everything smoothed out, the field tilted away below. For a farmer who had spent his entire life at ground level, that moment was a revelation. The fence lines stretching in perfect geometric order, the river curving through the bottoms, the church steeple they had looked at all their lives now at eye level, then below them, people on the ground, impossibly small, looking up. The pilot would bank the Jenny around the perimeter of the field and the world tilted on its axis, and you held the cockpit edge with both hands and realized you were still flying instead of falling, and that was the moment the barnstorming era produced in 250,000 American hearts. The world was bigger than the fence line. Gates estimated, in a 1926 interview with a Chicago newspaper, that the flying circus had carried more than 250,000 paying passengers. The entire commercial airline industry of the United States, such as it existed in that era, was not approaching those numbers. Ivan Gates, with his surplus Jennies and his advance men and his $5 ticket, may have done more to create the American public's appetite for air travel than any single person in aviation history. He certainly did it faster than anyone else. At the center of the flying operation was a quiet, precise young aviator named Clyde Pangborn, and I want to spend a moment with him because his story does not end in the cornfields of Ohio. Pangborn was from Washington State. He had trained to fly during the war, though the armistice came before he got overseas. He had bounced around the Pacific Northwest doing the solo barnstormer routine for a couple of years before Gates brought him east. By the time he joined the flying circus, he was in his mid-20s and already had more hours in his logbook than most pilots twice his age. He was the kind of pilot other pilots watched when they were not sure of something. He flew the crowd openers, the formation leads, the precision work. He trained the newer Gates pilots, he set the standards. Now, here is where it gets interesting. Gates had standards, and that set his operation apart from the barnstorming free-for-all that was killing pilots in ones and twos all across the country. In those years, the barnstorming era's glamour tends to obscure how genuinely dangerous it was, not just for performers but sometimes for spectators. Planes crashed into crowds. Wingwalkers fell from altitudes that left no margin. Parachutes malfunctioned. The mortality rate among barnstormers in the 1920s was something that today would shut down an operation within the hour. Gates had a practical reason to care about safety that went beyond basic decency. Every crash was a lawsuit. Every fatality was a newspaper story that ran ahead of him in the next town on the circuit and scared off the paying customers. So he put in rules. No aerobatics below 500 feet. No flying over the crowd with a performer on the wing. Minimum weather requirements, and if the ceiling was below 800 feet, the airshow portion was scrubbed. Dedicated, trained mechanics working on a schedule, engines inspected and overhauled, fabric replaced before it gave out, by the standards of his era. Ivan Gates was almost conservative, and that reputation was an asset. When local governments and county fair boards were getting nervous about the wilder end of the barnstorming trade, Gates could arrive with references and a safety record and an advance man who had already briefed the city council. He was the professional option in an industry that barely had a professional standard to measure against. The late 1920s brought changes that nobody in the barnstorming world was quite prepared for. The first was Lindbergh. When Charles Lindbergh landed at Le Bourget in May of 1927, he reorganized where the American public's aviation attention was pointed. Before that night in Paris, the barnstormer was the most exciting aviator in most people's frame of reference. After Paris, the exciting aviation was somewhere else, on long routes, in big machines, between cities that mattered. The barnstormer was starting to feel like a county fair act, which, to be fair, it partly was. The second change was regulation. The Air Commerce Act of 1926 had put the federal government in the business of certifying pilots and aircraft, and by the late 20s, those requirements were biting. surplus Jennies that had been flying for 8 years were failing airworthiness inspections. Pilots who had learned to fly in the war and never much worried about paperwork were suddenly required to hold licenses. The economics that had made barnstorming viable, buy a Jenny cheap, fly it until it quits, move on, that math was getting harder to work. Gates tried to evolve the operation, moving toward larger aircraft, exploring whether the circus could position itself as an air transport feeder, moving passengers between small towns that had no other air service. The vision was sound. The capital was not there to execute it. The Depression finished what the regulations had started. When people do not have $5 for groceries, they do not have $5 for an airplane ride. The Gates Flying Circus shut down in the early 1930s. But Clyde Pangborn went on. In October of 1931, just a few years after flying formation, over the cornfields of Ohio for Ivan Gates, Pangborn and a partner named Hugh Herndon departed from Sabashiro Beach in Japan in a Belanca monoplane called Miss Veedle. They had modified the landing gear to jettison over the water, saving the weight and drag for the long crossing ahead. 41 hours later, Pangborn put the Miss Veedle down belly first on a frozen field outside Wenatchee, Washington, first nonstop flight across the Pacific Ocean. The kid who learned the trade over Midwest County Fair circuits, flying for the man with the ledger book and the advance men and the $5 pitch, crossed the largest ocean on the planet.
The barnstorming era produced that. It produced a generation of pilots with thousands of hours in conditions that no airline and no military training program was yet offering. Low-level flying off-field operations, navigation by landmark and dead reckoning, engine management and machines that did not forgive carelessness. The barnstormers were not flying comfortable routes. They were flying whatever the day handed them, into whatever field presented itself, in whatever weather was doing. When commercial aviation needed experienced airmen for the mail routes and the early airliners, it reached into that community and found them. When the Army Air Corps expanded in the late 1930s with the clouds over Europe going dark, the instructor corps it needed was already there, seasoned by a decade of flying hard in unforgiving machines in front of crowds that could tell the difference. Ivan Gates understood entertainment, but he stumbled into something larger. He put 250,000 Americans in airplanes. He made flying feel like something a person could do, not a newspaper photograph, not a war story, an actual 10-minute ride above the fields of home, with the fence lines falling away below and the church steeple dropping past eye level and the realization settling in that the world was considerably bigger than you had been led to believe. That is not nothing. That is, in fact, quite a lot. My sources today include Joseph Korn's The Winged Gospel, Roger Bilstein's Flight in America, and period newspaper accounts from the 1920s available through the Library of Congress Digital Archive. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up.